So I'll start right out saying that I want to talk about the five hindrances tonight. But wait, before you sign off and say, oh my gosh, I've heard 100 of those talks, it's going to be a little bit different than it's usually talked about. And we're going to do an experiential exercise near the end that I hope might be interesting. But I do want to also just give a quick overview for those who may be less familiar with the five hindrances and why they're called that. So the Buddha named five mind states that are said to hinder or obstruct wisdom, as well as tranquility and calm and ease. You know, of course, there's more than that, but he named sort of five broad categories that we can fall into fairly easily that distract us in certain ways and also bring dukkha, bring stress or unsatisfaction in various ways. And another way to think of them is that they are five ways that we unskillfully react to experience that's happening. You know, these things are not just randomly appearing. They come in response to something that's happening. And so somehow our mind believes at some deeper level than our intelligence that this would be an appropriate response to what's happening in this moment. And it isn't necessarily. So the five, to name them, are desire, usually qualified as sense desire, you know, wanting some sensual experience. Aversion, I think we're all familiar with that one. Sloth and torpor, or I kind of prefer dullness, slowness, something like that. Agitation, also called restlessness and worry, or restlessness and remorse. So, kind of those two are kind of opposites. And then the final one is indecision, often translated as a doubt, but we might say indecision, wavering, something like that. And so the idea of sharing this list is not at all that you memorize it and carry it around like a intellectual cognitive prize, or write it down somewhere and refer to it. But actually, what we're supposed to do with this set is learn to recognize how they appear in our experience. What do they feel like? How do they operate at different times? Kind of like the way if we had a recurring noise in our car that didn't sound quite right, we would attune our attention to that and get a clearer idea. What does that really sound like? And when does that really happen? So that, you know, we might understand it better, maybe be able to explain it to somebody somewhere. But in this case, it's really information for us. How do these five states of suffering operate for us? So in AA, Alcoholics Anonymous, people are taught that when they have a craving for alcohol, they should use the acronym HALT, HALT, which stands for hungry, angry, lonely, and tired. And those are four common things that, if they're happening for a person, it's more likely that they will then respond to that by craving this thing that they're addicted to. And so instead of, so maybe a way to manage that craving can be to think about this acronym and consider, oh, are any of these four present? And if they are, then the person knows, oh, I can work with that. You know, if I'm hungry, I'll go get something to eat. You know, that will help me then with the emergence of this wish for alcohol at that time. So we look at the conditions that might be contributing to the craving that's going on. So, in the case of these five hindrances, there's kind of a similar idea is that instead of, as soon as we see a hindrance, instead of getting upset and trying to attack that directly, we could look at what might be conditioning its presence, what might be behind that crave, that hindrance coming on as an unskillful response to experience. And of course, there are many, many, many such conditions. That's why the hindrances are so hard to banish from our minds and work with. So there will be a lot to discover in this area for each practitioner. But I want to focus today on a particular area, since probably we're all at least somewhat familiar with the five hindrances. We don't need to go into great detail on how all of those are and so forth, but let's focus on one of these conditions that lies behind all of the hindrances at various times, and that is the degree to which we are actually attracted to these five hindrances. Part of us likes them, right? So maybe even invites them or allows them at some level. I know that in general, our wisdom mind and our, maybe our smart, intelligent mind, who's learned enough Buddhism to know, we generally don't want the hindrances in our mind, sure. But we do know also that we have them because we've conditioned them in there, right? We've been allowing them. At some point, at some time, we allowed them to take root, and that's why they're there, and they keep coming, they keep growing. So we have these and unskillful reactions. There's nothing to be like ashamed of or upset about. They come with being a human being. We've all got them. We've all conditioned that into our minds. So then, the question is, what's going on there at a little bit deeper level? Why are we kind of encouraging this? Or what do we like about these five? What's in it for us, in a sense? So I'm calling this talk Second Arrows, Attraction to the Hindrances. And that's because in another teaching, the Buddha describes how the untrained mind will tend to pile up arrows on of dukkha, suffering or stress or unsatisfactoriness. And that's, we may not be able to prevent the first arrow from striking, some physical pain that just comes with having a body, or even the first instance of a hindrance if it gets turned up from some memory that appears from somewhere or something. But then we can learn not to add on a second, third, fourth, etc. arrow. All of the hindrances are dukkha. And if we add on being attracted to them, we're adding on a second arrow because being attracted to something that's unskillful is itself unskillful. So we're adding on a second unskillfulness, right? So let's talk about these strange attractions. You guys heard of like strange attractors in science. So these are like strange attractors. Why are we attracted to these five? So I want to talk about these in a little bit more concretely. We'll talk about each one, each hindrance, and why we might like it. But I won't go in the usual order. I'm going to start in, with attraction to or liking of aversion. This is one of the biggest ones. We like it. We like to be judgmental. We like to dislike things or protest their presence in the world or declare that they should be obliterated. They shouldn't happen. We like that. Why? Aversion feels powerful. We know. We're clear about that. We can have a crystalline clarity that this is bad and wrong. And it feels kind of orderly and complete and tidy in our mind to make that judgment like that. And it's justified, right? It feels justified also. So this is a way that we can find, let's say, the part of aversion that's attractive, the powerful part, and get it, attracted to that. actually drawn to it, actually encourage it in some ways. To give a concrete example, there's a pretty common pattern that's acceptable in our society in how we relate to people that I like to call bonding through mutual outrage. And that is where I see some of you have already got it just from the name, and that's where one person says, "Did you hear about such and such? Can you believe that such and such is happening?" And the other person says, "I know, it's just awful." And the first one says, "Yeah, it's just, it can't, this just keeps going on. I remember back when such and such, and it never got any better." Yeah. And so there you are. You're having a nice bonding relationship with somebody over how awful something is, how outrageous it is. And we're all outraged together, and then we're bonded. So it's kind of funny, but it is enticing, when someone that we know well and knows, and we share values with them, we share views with them, baits us in that way. It's so easy to just jump in. But really, what you're feeding is mutual aversion between the two of you, and so that will aversion will come back if we keep feeding it. Other people sometimes use anger as a motivator. If I weren't upset about something, if I didn't have this righteous anger, I wouldn't stand up for what's important. I wouldn't be able to go out and do my work in the world. I can see that, but if we do it repeatedly, we might stop believing that anything except anger could motivate us. Anything besides anger could be a foundation for action. There are other options that are more skillful. So that's something also to consider if we use anger in that way. The Buddha said that aversion has a honeyed tip and poison root. So the honeyed tip is what we like. It tastes good, it's sweet in the moment. But it down below, it's going to a poison root that's connected into our heart, and that causes ongoing dukkha, for us and for others. So we might look, if we tend to have aversion frequently, if there's some way in which we are inviting it at some level underneath, or allowing it, or supporting it in some way. And if we work with those conditions, then the aversion will keep coming because it's habitual. We don't end it for a long time along the path, but at least we wouldn't be feeding it as much if we understood the ways in which we're subtly putting fuel on that fire. And then another one that's a pretty big one is the liking of or attraction to restlessness and remorse or worry. So this is, how does liking of this one come about? I mean, it's anxiety and worry are actually quite unpleasant states. So it's not that we directly want those in our life, I know, but there are social groups, families in particular, in which caring is shown by being upset. So if you aren't upset and agitated about something that's going on, it's an indication that you don't care. And so we all want to be caring, so we buy into that one. And we allow ourselves to get swept up and upset and frenzied about things that are happening. But in doing so, although we're showing everybody how caring we are subtly feeding restlessness and aversion, and then and restlessness and agitation, restlessness and remorse. And then that will come in our meditation because we've been subtly encouraging it. So check out if you believe maybe underneath somewhere that becoming agitated and upset is a necessary response in order to take action. Again, we have the use of this as a way to take action. We might forget that there are other means, love, compassion, that can show care also. And then we would need to learn to distinguish in our heart which is agitation that is due to restlessness and which is wise action coming forth as a compassionate response, even strong, fast action to help somebody. Another way that we subtly support this hindrance is through keeping busy, let's say. Keeping busy is a great way not to feel dukkha or face the reality of a situation. We can get busy around it, and then it shields us a little bit from having to really stop and take in what's going on, what something feels like, especially if it feels painful or scary or an area where we're helpless, actually, in some way. So we jump in to keeping busy instead. This is particularly common in avoiding thinking about death, for example. We can keep busy for quite a few decades on that one. So Gil once told a friend of mine who had this habit fairly strongly, no one ever got enlightened by keeping busy. And it's true. But again, there are other ways to be motivated, to take action, to be helpful, to do something meaningful, valuable in the world, besides the agitation that avoids, that's really an avoidance. And as we get stronger in our mindfulness practice, I know we all have a mindfulness practice. As we get stronger in that, we actually do increase our capacity to be with things that are not so comfortable. And so you might find that if there's something that you know you're kind of avoiding by keeping busy, keeping your calendar full, doing a lot of things for other people, you might revisit it at some point if you know what it is that you're avoiding and see if you have more capacity now than you did, say, 10 years ago, 5 years ago even. I've discovered things like that in my own practice where I kind of knew I wasn't addressing it. And I found when I turned to it again during some time that felt safe, felt appropriate, found I had more capacity in my heart than I thought. Some novel thing could come forth through the Dharma by reopening to something that I kind of knew was there but hadn't been looking at directly. And then there's liking dullness and drowsiness, or sloth and torpor. Most recently, I heard this translated as stiffness and slowness. I kind of like that. That's how the mind can feel, right? The mind actually feels stiff sometimes, like a little hard to work this, like those stiff muscles in the morning. The mind can be like that. So sometimes there's attraction to this hindrance simply because it happens that sloth and torpor can be pleasant. Actually, it's kind of dreamy, soft, fuzzy. We can just hang out there. I know my mind can do that. Sometimes in meditation, especially at the end of the day, I'm a little tired, and I'll just go into kind of a dull state. And I think, oh yeah, I'm kind of peaceful, kind of tranquil, kind of mindful, not really. So, you know, it's have to be honest about that. So in the meantime, of course, we're feeding this hindrance, making it more likely that it will come back again sometime. So we have to be careful there. And then another way where we can subconsciously maybe feed this hindrance is I noticed in my own mind that sometimes when I was trying to do something that I wasn't too sure about, or wasn't that interested in or something, I would give about 80% of my effort to it. And I didn't know exactly why, but it's like I was holding back a little bit and I could see. And it was really laziness. And I finally saw that what I was doing was realizing that if I don't give 100% quite, then I don't have to face the fact that I might fail at this activity. If I fail at it, if I give 100% and it doesn't work and I fail at it, in a sense, fail in quotes, I really failed. I gave 100% and it didn't work. But if I only give 80%, then there's always that little bit, that maybe that's why I didn't succeed. I could sort of subconsciously hang out there. And when I saw that, I realized, oh, this is not skillful. This is not a skillful approach. And it's not that it's always like 100% or 0%. That's the only way we can apply ourselves. But still, this kind of holding back out of slight laziness so as not to feel the impact of not succeeding, not a good idea. Not a good thing to be feeding in the moment. So then we get to liking of sensual desire. So in a sense, of course we're attracted to sensual desire. The reward is obvious when we, when we support that mind state. And also it's actually, it's healthy for a human being to seek happiness, to seek safety and comfort and well-being, and to set up a life that works for us and those around us, those we care about. So what's the problem with pursuing desires, really? Why is this a hindrance anyway? So here we'll have to get a little bit more fine-tuned on this one. So, there's nothing wrong with enjoying good things that come along or making choices that bring us ease or joy. It's just that we go a little bit too far in this. We so easily get attached to sense pleasures and pursue them over other things that might be more wholesome, like helping others or developing ourselves spiritually. We can pursue the sense pleasures instead of those other things. So, another thing we do is that we don't quite realize the downsides of various sensual pursuits. So, sense pleasures and the desires that lead to them do come at a cost, and we rarely do the cost-benefit analysis too carefully. So, that's just an encouragement to see all sides. Yes, it's okay to, pursue this particular food that I'm seeking right now or something, and check out the cost that might be coming with that. I'm not really listening to my friend talking because I'm thinking about the refrigerator, or, I'm spending more money than I need to on this or some such. So always look for the if you train yourself to look for the cost that something is coming at, in addition to the obvious benefits of it, in the case of sense pleasures, you'll have a more balanced view. And so it'll be easier to notice which ones really are wholesome. And then there's also the same issue that we had with aversion, but just on the other side. So when people use aversion as a motivator, they stop seeing that there could be, say, compassion as a wholesome motivator. And in the same way, there's if we just use the pursuit of, fulfilling desires as the way to get the things we need in our life, we might not believe that there are actually other pathways by which things come to us besides I wanted it and I pursued it. Can you imagine other things, other ways that you could acquire the things that you care about and need? Could there be other motivations for getting our needs met besides wanting? I'll just leave that as an exercise for the reader. But there are similar ones. There's love, there's compassion, there's generosity. So many things come to us actually through our generosity. It's almost funny to see how that operates. So many other ways. You may not need the wanting as much as you think you do. And then this attraction to wanting can appear in other ways too. Sometimes we just have a sort of a background mood of wanting. And it's so interesting to watch the mind looking for something to want. Have you ever experienced that? It's like there's just wanting in the mind, and we're, you know, flipping through the catalog, looking for something to want, or, you know, browsing the internet, looking for something to want. Amazon even plays into this now by telling us about other things that we might want that are related to what we're looking at. You know, it's all calculated. Actually, I even know somebody who opened up their browser and it happened to open to the Google search page, and they found themselves saying, "Oh, the Google search page. What do I want to know right now?" You know, it's like, what could I put into that search box and get information on? So the mind just wanted to want something. There's this wonderful poem called Cake that I would like to read. Look, you want it, you devour it, and then, good as it was, you realize it wasn't what you exactly wanted. What you wanted exactly was wanting. Did we want the cake or did we want the wanting? So, yeah. I realize this is the origin of the phrase, have your cake and eat it too, right? We want to want it and we want to eat it. So something there. Actually, I have a story about attraction to wanting that I think is quite touching. I went and did I gave a weekend retreat for a group in a completely different area, and it was a while ago. And at the end of it, you know, there was the Donna envelope passed around, and people offered checks and envelopes and things in this envelope, and I brought it home, and I opened it and was looking through the various things, and there was one small envelope that was sealed up, and when I opened it, it had $3 in cash and a note. This was for a weekend retreat that I gave, and the note was from a woman who explained that she was recently out of staying at the mental hospital, and she had gone there because somehow something had gone awry with a long-term mental condition that she knew she had, and she had spent all of her money at the thrift store, like thousands of dollars, and her children had intervened and gotten her some help, and now she was back and kind of putting her life together, but she really said she truly could not give more than this $3, but that she really, really wanted to be there for the weekend and make an offering. And I recognized the name. She signed her name. I didn't know her before, but she had asked some questions during the weekend. She had really asked good Dharma questions. She had been tracking the teachings, and I was so touched by this, you know, beautiful note that she wrote and her very simple offering. There was a lot of merit in that small act of generosity, but it, you know, it came from a mind that was very attracted to wanting and not able to control that easily. So this is not a trivial area of life. And not a trivial hindrance to consider whether we're feeding it. And then finally, we get to the last of the hindrances, doubt or indecision. And this one, we can like this one too. We can be attracted even to this. It means maybe literally a kind of wavering. And in the cases where the Buddha talks about in more detail what this hindrance refers to, or what this mind state, let's say, refers to, is that it actually refers to uncertainty about what is wholesome and what is unwholesome. So in other words, it's the opposite of wisdom. And we sit there wavering. Is this right? Is that right? Should I do this? Should I do that? I'm not sure which one is actually skillful or more skillful. Could there be attraction to a state like that? Actually, there can be. There can be. I see it most often in people who are highly dependent on the intellect or the cognitive mind rather than direct experience. And so if they, so they're relying on thinking in inappropriate circumstances, which leads to confusion, such that skeptical doubt looks like the safer path. It's like, I really don't know. Mind, my poor thinking mind can't figure this one out. So it looks like a safer, clearer path to just be doubtful and just say, and just, the result is maybe to ask a lot of questions or hedge on being clear about what they're doing or waffle rather than to risk making one's own decision about what is wholesome or true. So it's interesting. I find that people who doubt a lot often don't go quite far enough. They don't doubt their doubt. They don't. It's possible to doubt even that. So the question is, if we've realized, I've sort of thrown all of these out here as, are there ways in which we are subtly feeding one or more of these hindrances? And, could that be one of the conditions through which they keep coming back in our mind? We keep seeing them in our meditations or our life. And so the question is, how can we work with this kind of attraction? Maybe instead of continuing to bang on the hindrance, we could sometimes direct our attention toward the part of our mind that actually likes these five states. The Buddha was sometimes asked to teach on what was called the Dhamma in brief. Someone would come to him and say, "Would you please just give me a pithy, concise nugget of the Dharma so that I can go off on retreat and practice?" And one time, he said it a lot of different ways. There was, I think there's over 40 suttas where somebody comes and asks him that. And in one of them, he says, "Yes, my pithy nugget for you is let go of desire for anything that is dukkha." Well, the hindrances are dukkha. So apparently, the Buddha knew that we can have desire for things that are suffering, actually. So, as noted earlier, it's unwholesome to be attracted to what is unwholesome. It's the second arrow. So, how do we decide about this? We could do various contemplations. There are cognitive approaches. What's in it for me? What's in it for me to be attracted to this? What's the payoff there? And is that all that's going on? Or is there a cost also? I mentioned that earlier. There are a number of payoffs. We've talked about some of them, the clarity that we can feel, the power. There can be emotional comfort in some of these hindrances, buying into them. We can try to attain safety or security through them, although it's not anywhere near as safe or secure as those hindrances we took at the beginning. Or even entertainment. Check it out. Some of these things are just entertaining. Fantasies, for instance, are kind of entertaining. Or we're often, bolstering our self-story or our self-image through these hindrances. So one way we can tell if we've really identified with the hindrance is if we wouldn't be sure who we are if we weren't enacting it. The most common one for that is aversion. If you weren't angry and upset about certain things, would you still know who you were? For some, that's a relative distinction. But I think the more effective approach is direct. So I want to offer a kind of a direct visual experience for you. I want to kind of see if this works. This will be the last thing that we do together this evening. So I'm going to share an image that I hope is tranquil looking for you. So check this out. There are actually two images, and you could focus on whichever one you prefer. But so just have a look at these images and kind of let them impact you emotionally. We're not going to stay with them too long. So just feel, is there a resonance for you? Have you felt something like that in meditation? And now I'm going to temporarily have you bring up the hindrances. So let's start with aversion. Bring up something that you find irritating, annoying, a person, a place. Let that mind state come in. Does it conflict with what you're looking at? Oh, that's so irritating when she does that. And feel that. Feel the non-resonance between irritation and that. Then you can let go of the irritation. And then maybe bring to mind your favorite food, the one that you have kind of a weakness for. And really, wouldn't it be great to taste that? Some great taste that we've had recently. And is there a disparity between that wanting or that taste and the images? Maybe feel in the body. Those. And if there's a gap, notice the gap. Notice the tension. And then you can let go of the wanting. And we'll just do one more. Consider something or a time when you felt anxious, agitated, flustered. You couldn't remember something. You thought you'd lost your keys. You worried about a diagnosis that you hadn't heard the result of yet. And does that have a disharmony with the image, some discord? And then we can release the restlessness and worry and stop sharing. So it might be that registering that feeling of discord, if you felt it, between this state of ease and tranquility and the signature feelings that are associated with the hindrances, maybe that could be useful in meditation. If we start feeling something that's more on the easeful side, then if a hindrance starts to emerge, we can feel that stretching, that disharmony starting to happen. It can be a way to help us understand not to feed that state that's coming in, not to like, not to encourage, foster the hindrance that's coming in. Okay, so I think we need to wind up in a moment. This is such a rich topic. I feel like I could go on for a while, but really, I hope the promise that you see is that we don't need to feed these, and our wisdom doesn't want to, knows that they're not helpful, and yet there's some part of us maybe that secretly does get something out of these. And could we be wiser about that part? Rather than always trying to just work with the hindrances or et cetera, work with the part that gets something out of them and see the non-wisdom of that. That can help a lot in letting the mind release those so that we can be present, so that we can be connected to wisdom and compassion and the mind states that nourish us and that support us and those around us.